Today is Thursday, the 14th day of July, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington, D.C. Coming up, the new British Prime Minister is faced with the task of handling her country's exit from the European Union.
I've covered a lot of stories over a 30-year career. Brexit has been one of the most surreal I've ever covered.
You'll hear much more from VOA's Jamie Dettner about that. Also ahead, the U.S. Secretary of State reportedly is carrying a request to Moscow asking for a cooperative military arrangement in Syria. Now we hear from VOA's Steve Herman, ending a 25-year stint covering Asia. It's all on today's International Edition. We start on International Edition today in merry old England, which maybe isn't so merry today. European Parliament Chief Martin Schulz is blasting the cabinet picks of the new British Prime Minister Theresa May, all part of what they call a dangerously vicious cycle that will hurt Britons in the long run. Theresa May became Britain's new prime minister Wednesday and immediately put together her cabinet to start the tough job of extracting Britain from the European Union. According to Schulz, the cabinet picks were designed more to solve internal party political issues than to promote the national interest of Britain. In a surprise choice, May named the former London mayor Boris Johnson as her foreign secretary. Johnson led the campaign to drop out of the EU. He angered and frustrated many Brits who voted to remain, along with other European leaders who believe Britain made a great mistake. And some of the ways he chose to describe some of the people he was against is open to question. VOA's Jamie Dettner is standing by. He's been covering this issue surrounding the Brexit vote and its aftermath, and What's the overall picture in London?
Well, there's a lot of incredulity about the appointment of Boris Johnson, and really, I suppose one could sum it up as a pooled surprise, both in the UK and across Europe, not just Schulz. The French Prime Minister has said that Johnson's a liar, for example. There are a lot of jokes about the appointment. He is a man who isn't noted for his diplomatic language. But there may be a logic in this. I mean, conservative insiders say to me that if you look at what she's done, not just with Boris Johnson, who is a Brexiteer, but also the appointment of the International Trade Secretary being Liam Fox, who's also a Brexiteer, and the appointment of David Davis as the minister who's going to be in charge of negotiating the exit from the European Union. The logic isn't just about a kind of facile internal party dynamic here. She's really brought in the Brexiteers, some would argue, to give her cover. Part of the thrust may well be they were the ones who broke it, so they're the ones who are going to have to live with it and repair and salvage what can be done out of the Brexit referendum.
Well, Johnson has already come out today in some of his first public statements, if not the first since the new appointment, saying that we're going to go along with the vote and go along with Brexit, but there are other ways that we can act with Europe. Now, where's he going with that?
There have always been question marks about how serious Boris was, who I worked with actually years ago at the Daily Telegraph. He's a man who can change his viewpoints pretty quickly, and there's always been a suspicion that he isn't ideologically a Brexiteer, but he was using, really, the referendum and the referendum campaign to further advance his own political ambitions. So I'm not too sure it's going to be that difficult for Johnson really kind of slightly to change his spots. If you read between the lines of what May has been saying in the run-up to the referendum, after the referendum, there are hints that it would be more Brexit-lite rather than completely cutting off away from the European Union.
And what about Boris Johnson overall as Foreign Secretary? With some of the things he has said about other leaders, including Western leaders, including the U.S. President, how does he come off of that to getting into a role of a foreign minister?
Well, that's where I think is the biggest gamble. At this level of politics, I think there can be recovery in terms of relationships. Boris is a very charming man. He'll be dealing directly, obviously, with U.S. diplomats and European diplomats. He will be kept away from Brexit negotiations, interestingly. I think there'll have to be a big effort by Boris to zip up a little bit, be more careful what he says in the future, and to use that charm to overcome some of the offence he's caused to European and American politicians. One interesting area that hasn't had so much coverage is Syria policy. He has, you know, in the last few months, really focused on saying that we should be defeating ISIS, and that may well mean helping President Assad. You know, obviously, the Syrian rebels are appalled at the appointment of Boris Johnson and see that as a danger for them. But I think that probably he'd be slapped down on that and may well have him following British government policy.
And it keeps getting more and more interesting every day, doesn't it, Jamie?
As I said to you on a phone call we had a few weeks ago, I've covered a lot of stories over a 30-year career. Brexit has been one of the most surreal I've ever covered.
VOA's Jamie Detmer joining us. Thanks, Jamie. Jamie just mentioned the Syrian conflict. It happens that U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is visiting Moscow today in an effort to secure Russian cooperation in anti-terror operations in Syria, despite a breakdown in U.S.-Russia relations over Ukraine, NATO, and other issues that have left both sides simmering with distrust. The Secretary of State's 2 days of talks with the Russians are formally expected to touch on a wide range of issues, but leaked reports first published by the Washington Post suggest the U.S. diplomat is offering Putin something dramatic, a U.S.-Russia military alliance against the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, and other extremist groups in Syria. Now, prior to departing for Moscow, Kerry declined to elaborate, but noted he would be meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, as well as his Kremlin counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, and Kremlin officials also offered few details of what is going to be said. Time to turn our attention to social media. Andrew Palcheski is here, and I hear it is more the U.S. presidential race that is overtaking social media today. Is that correct?
Absolutely. You know, we usually have trending topics about Donald Trump, but the number two man might be getting more attention today, and that is speculated to be Indiana Governor Mike Pence. Now, there are strong rumors that Donald Trump's going to announce tomorrow in New York that Governor Pence will be his running mate on his ticket. Fascinating that on social media, people have already kind of self-confirmed this. They said, oh, well, Trump's picking Pence. The Trump campaign has come out and said, not so fast. We are not making an announcement yet. We're waiting till tomorrow. So nothing has been confirmed yet. But already people are starting to scrutinize Governor Pence, looking at his record, how he voted. He was a congressman for about 12 years before he became governor. So they're looking at that side of his record. You have actually some Trump supporters who are saying, well, we don't want him. We want Newt Gingrich or Governor Chris Christie. So there's some strife over that pick or potential pick. And then others saying, well, you know what? It's a solid pick. He's reassuring conservatives. He's picking a solid conservative and somebody with a lot of government expertise, somebody who spent a dozen years in Congress, somebody who was a governor. One tweet that I saw that actually Governor Pence sent out back in December, where he said that banning Muslims from the U.S. would be unconstitutional and a terrible thing to do. Well, that's one of the kind of hallmarks of Donald Trump's campaign. So that'll be interesting if he does get selected as the vice presidential nominee, how they might work together.
All leading up to next week's Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio, where a lot of the stalwarts of the Republican Party say they're not showing up.
Yeah, well, that was the other big story on social media today, is the list of who is speaking at the Republican National Convention. A lot of people kind of tipped off that maybe Pence would be the VP nominee because he wasn't listed on the speaker's list, but some other hopefuls like Newt Gingrich and Chris Christie were. So they said it was a very conspicuous omission that Pence wasn't listed, maybe because they have a slot for him Wednesday night when the vice presidential nominee speaks. Who knows? But a lot of talk about Tim Tebow, the former college football star at the University of Florida. He's going to be speaking at the convention, and he's kind of the keynote name that everybody's been jumping on, and people saying, really? That's the best they can do is find a former college quarterback.
Who never made it in professional football.
And he didn't make it very far in professional football, but other people saying that they're very excited to see him and that it'll bring maybe some young people in, some sports fans in, so we'll see how that plays out, what he'll be talking about. He's also, I believe, an evangelical Christian, so it may assuage some of the fears of the evangelical Christians who are hesitant about supporting Trump. So we'll see how that all plays out, and I have no doubt that it'll all be covered on Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat, I know that the RNC is launching an app where you'll have 360-degree video that you can watch from the convention floor. So we're in the whole new digital world now with these political conventions.
And also, you can't, VOA and International Edition will be covering every aspect of it.
Well, that goes without saying. We will absolutely will be there.
But you better say it.
I better say it anyway. Right, VOA and International Edition will be there. No, we will be covering the convention wall-to-wall. We have some very talented reporters heading over to Cleveland for the Republicans and up to Philadelphia next week for the Democrats.
That's a pal, Andrew Palcheski, at APAL is his Twitter handle. Is that correct?
That is correct.
What's mine?
Yours is at VOA Melman.
Gee, thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Andrew Palcheski here on International Edition. Among the top stories in the World Series, president says Russia has never asked him to relinquish power as U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry heads to Moscow, where he's expected to push for a revised ceasefire and roadmap to peace. The European Parliament chief blasts the cabinet picks of the new British prime minister as part of what he called a dangerously vicious cycle that will hurt Britons in the long run. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg says her critical comments about Donald Trump were ill-advised. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition, and this is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Flying some 250 million light years away in what is described as a quiet and unexceptional section of the universe, astronomers have discovered a gigantic and quite unusual galaxy. What makes UGC 1382 such an oddity is that they believe it was formed from the parts of other galaxies. So they've named it the Frankenstein Galaxy after the fictional monster made from body parts taken from various corpses.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
After sifting through data gathered by a couple of NASA space telescopes, along with several ground-based telescopes, the astronomers realized that the galaxy was a rotating disk of low-density gas that is 7 times wider than the Milky Way. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. The Philippines Foreign Ministry has called on China to respect Wednesday's landmark ruling by the Permanent Court of Arbitration rejecting Beijing's claim of sovereignty over most of the South China Sea. The statement came ahead of an Asia-Europe summit in Mongolia, which will be attended by both China and the Philippines. In the wake of this ruling, U.S. State Department spokesman Mark Toner was asked about the landing of 2 Chinese civilian aircraft on reefs in the contested Spratly Islands.
You know, we still see these kinds of actions as raising tensions unnecessarily rather than lowering them. And we want to see a lowering of tensions. So this is really for all claimants, as I said, to take advantage of the ruling and show restraint and take advantage of the opportunity presented by the tribunal's finding or decision to work together to manage these. That's our only focus here, I guess, is we don't have a dog in this fight other than our belief that, or other than obviously our treaty obligations, but also our belief in freedom of navigation. But what we want to see in this very tense part of the Pacific, we want to see de-escalation of tensions, and we want to see all claimants take a moment to look at how we can find a peaceful way forward.
White House spokesman Josh Earnest Wednesday said this is not a time for provocation and deeper conflict, but the ruling should point toward a peaceful and diplomatic resolution of competing claims. Several Obama administration officials said Wednesday the U.S. is using quiet diplomacy to persuade China's neighbors to avoid acting aggressively in the wake of the ruling. RAND Corporation political scientist Scott Harrell told VOA's Victor Beatty that Washington is also trying to diffuse the idea in Beijing that the ruling is part of a U.S. effort to isolate China.
I think the U.S. is looking to try to signal to China that the U.S. expects China to live up to and adhere to international law and to abide by the rulings, but that this is not part of a broader signal that the U.S. is looking to line up countries in the region in a permanent coalition to oppose China on all fronts, on all issues. However, I do think that it is the case that in almost every country in the Asia-Pacific, the reality is most of these countries regard the ruling as a good thing because it signals that China's ambitious nine-dash line claim to the entirety of the South China Sea has been denied and given a forceful rejection by the international legal system. And it will impose costs on China if China chooses to stay outside of that system. I think the debate in the U.S. right now, as I understand it, is between those who think that the best approach is to give Beijing the space to reach the conclusion that it needs to find an off-ramp by which it can begin to move itself into accord with international legal norms, and those who think that China has painted itself into this corner and that it should not be given any opportunity to wiggle out of having to live up to those commitments, and that if you signal that there's something like a China exception whereby this ruling's impact can be muted or ignored for some period of time or even altogether, then you're really running a substantial risk.
The state-run China Daily warned Thursday that any attempt to act on the tribunal's ruling, which it said was based on lies, distortions, and unwarranted procedures, would be tantamount to directly challenging China's sovereignty. I'm Ira Nelman in Washington. This is VOA.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This is International Edition. VOA Southeast Asia Bureau Chief Steve Herman today ends more than a quarter of a century of reporting in Asia. In just a few hours, he heads to his new assignment as VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent based here in Washington at the State Department. Steve has been witness to many major happenings over his 25-plus years in Asia, and he joins us now from Bangkok. Steve, thanks for taking time to be with us. Of all the stories you've covered and the changes you observe, what ranks at or near the top of your list?
Well, I think the most dramatic story was being on the ground in Fukushima, Japan, 24 hours after that magnitude 9 earthquake and tsunami that resulted in the meltdown of nuclear reactors, and being very close to that as it was unfolding was obviously something that I'll never forget. Less dramatic, perhaps, but numerous trips into Afghanistan, an effort that costs many thousands of lives and billions of dollars, and it is still obviously an ongoing story, but to watch that unfold over the years. And then to do reporting, for example, the end of the civil war in Sri Lanka, where the Tamil Tigers were defeated, and being in a helicopter and flying over the devastation that had led to the defeat of the rebels by the Sri Lankan military, that was something I'll definitely never forget.
Taking a couple of steps back, how is Asia overall, and I know just to group Asia in as an entire continent probably isn't fair, but how has Asia overall changed as far as its place in the world, as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think we have to talk about China and then the rest of Asia, because China is a huge story in itself, but what has happened in China to a smaller and more modest degree has happened through much, but not all, of the region, which is a tremendous building of infrastructure, a rising middle class in many countries where there was just a very thin layer of upper class, and everybody else was struggling, and we have seen in many countries a rising middle class, and that has had social and political ramifications. And then there are countries that have just had, you know, disaster after unstable government, and you know, some would say they almost seem to be cursed in their bad luck. You know, Bangladesh and Nepal come to mind. Despite extremely resilient and energetic people in both countries, both nature and politics has really seemed to have held them back to some degree over the past decades.
What about personalities? Who comes to mind as you think back about who's had an effect on history?
Well, I think it may be premature because we could have some figures right now on the scene that will emerge in history books decades or centuries from now as very pivotal figures at this time. But obviously, an unfolding story is with Aung San Suu Kyi in Burma, Myanmar, where she has gone from winning elections to house arrest to now being the de facto leader of her country, and huge expectations placed upon her. And obviously, we can look at people like Xi Jinping in China and Shinzo Abe in Japan and Park Geun-hye in South Korea, all seen as quite conservative and strong leaders, and the verdict of history is still out on them. And of course, we have the third generation of the Kim family in North Korea, and that is still an unfinished story, and one that I think is going to continue to make headlines for many years to come.
Well, congratulations, Steve, on your new appointment. Have a good flight. Look forward to seeing you here in the newsroom in Washington. That's wrapping up our program. I'm Ira Melvin in Washington. Enjoy your day or night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The shea tree is a traditional African food plant. Today it has many commercial uses. Increased trade in shea products, benefiting the economies of many African nations, will be the result of a $13 million five-year agreement signed this month in Accra, Ghana, between the Global Shea Alliance, or GSA, and the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, to promote shea markets worldwide and improve sustainable production in Africa. The shea industry is changing, and companies, governments, and donors are investing more in sustainable production and improving the benefit to 16 million women collectors and processors, says Mumuni Konate, president of the Global Shea Alliance. The goal of this critical partnership is to help women collectors and processors organize into cooperatives, obtain equipment and training, and improve the financial benefit from the sale of their products. Stronger and more profitable women's groups will process more shea, improve quality, and protect the trees. During the Global Shea Alliance's annual conference in Accra, Ghana, USAID West Africa Mission Director Alex Deprez said, "We know well the benefits of increased trade for rural communities across Africa. The partnership will match up to $6.5 million in USAID funds with $6.5 million in private sector funding raised by the GSA to implement promotional and sustainability activities in Benin, Burkina Faso, Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana, Mali, and Nigeria. These activities include launching research projects to improve shea tree planting materials, supporting tree planting campaigns and improved management of parklands, launching resource conservation projects to reduce wood and water use, hosting annual conferences and exhibitions in Africa, the United States, and the European Union, constructing 250 warehouses, health and safety initiatives, improving financial benefits by 50%, and providing capacity building and training for 137,500 women shea collectors and processors, and a variety of other international engagements to grow shea markets worldwide. the GSA is pioneering efforts to grow markets and improve the livelihoods of rural women and their families that stand at the base of the she value chain, said USAID West Africa Mission Director Deprez. We are proud to partner in these activities.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.